Ghoulish greetings, everybody. Thank you so much for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your day. Those amazing tunes that you're about to hear are, as always, courtesy of the amazing Bobby Mackey. And, of course, I am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Coming home. Coming home.
Back in 2018, a gentleman named Cloyd Steiger and myself, we bought each other's books. And a few weeks ago, I reached out to him about possibly being a guest on the podcast, and thankfully, he said yes. Cloyd worked the streets as a homicide detective with the Seattle Police Department for 22 years of his 36-year career. That is so impressive in my book. Now, during that time, he investigated some of the most notorious murderers in Seattle. From serial killers, domestic terrorists, to psychotic killers. Today, he is going to give us a view from inside the yellow tape. We are going to hear about some intense cases that he had worked during his time as a homicide detective. He may have retired from the Seattle PD, but now he is a private investigator. As he says in his book, "Murder is in my DNA." Cloyd Steiger, welcome to Paranormal Prowlers Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day and stopping by. I'm really happy to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks.
You have a book titled Homicide: A View from Inside the Yellow Tape, and we're going to talk about some of those cases that you discuss in that book. First off, talking about the book, where can people find it?
Well, it's, you know, obviously Amazon.com, I think BarnesandNoble.com, Walmart, online, all those kind of places have it.
Good to know. Cloyd, you were in law enforcement in the Seattle area for 36 years, 22 of them as a homicide detective. What made you choose this phenomenal path?
Well, you know, I decided I wanted to become a police officer when I was little, like 10 years old. You know, I thought that would be cool. I watched TV shows and read books and thought that'd be cool. So that's what I made the decision early, and I never wavered for it. I just kept studying ways, books about being a police officer and things like that. And then as I got older into high school, I started reading a lot of true crime stuff. And then I thought, well, I'd really like to eventually be a homicide detective, but I didn't know if I was going to be able to do that because it's pretty competitive to get into homicide and there's only so many positions, but that was what my goal was. And you had to be 20 and a half to apply for the Seattle Police Department. And when I exactly was 20 and a half years old, I called the Seattle Police Department and asked if they were hiring. And they said they were. They had a test coming up. And they got my information and sent me a test packet of about 100 pages of stuff. And I literally pored over it day and night until I almost memorized the entire packet. And then I had a friend of mine, when I said I was going to apply, he thought he would do it too. So he applied. And then we got testing dates. His was on a Saturday, mine was on a Sunday. And he went in on Saturday, and I waited for him to come back and waited. And then he finally, hours later, he came back. I said, "How was it?" He said, "Man, there were like 1,000 people there."
Oh.
And, oh, my gosh. And then the next day, I went in on Sunday, and there were another 1,000 people there. And I thought, oh, man, I'm probably not going to get hired here. But I went through the process, took the test. And a couple weeks later, I got a card in the mail saying that I was number 13 on their list. And they wanted to start the process. So I did. And it's about a 6-month process from taking the test to actually getting hired. And I went through all those steps. And then one Thursday afternoon, I got a call and it said, "Report to the police academy Monday morning." So it's like,
wow.
Okay. And it was, I was off, you know, and that's what started it.
That is amazing. I mean, that's phenomenal. So did your friend get in too?
No, he didn't get hired.
Oh no, bummer. Well, that's wild that there were so many people there both days.
I know.
And I mean, that's just amazing to me that that many people want to help and make a difference, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot different today.
yeah, I'm sure it is. So talk a little, if you will, and I understand about changing names and if you can't talk about certain things, so
no.
If that's the case, but can you tell us a little bit about the very first murder that you ever worked on?
As a detective?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, because I went on murders when I was a patrol officer, too. I'd been to several homicide scenes. I didn't have investigative responsibility, but I responded to them, because that's the first person that goes to those.
Yeah, let's talk about your very first one, then.
By the way, in my book, I didn't change anybody's name except an informant I had. I changed his name. Everybody else has their real names.
Oh, gotcha. Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, the first murder I had the primary responsibility on was a little girl, 7 years old, named Angelica Robinson. Wow. And she had been, her mother was semi-homeless, and they were sleeping in this ramshackle place in an area of Seattle called Rainier Valley when some people came in and started shooting indiscriminately around the place, and she was asleep in bed and was hit and killed by a bullet. That was the first one I ever got responsibility for. So we went in there, and I was working at that time. That case with my partner was Walt Manning, is its name. And we worked basically day and night for a few days until we finally were able to figure out who they were and make the arrest. And they were like teenagers. The youngest was 13. The oldest was like 17.
Oh, my God.
We were them in charge with murder, yeah.
Oh, that's absolutely just gut-wrenching. And it's so sad. I don't know how it was back then, Cloyd, but I know, like, I was just, like, walking out doing laps in the backyard this morning, and I was listening to, I think it's Murder in America podcast, and they were talking about these two killers who were, I think, 15 and 16 at the time, and they were inspired by the movie Scream and by the Columbine Massacre in Colorado, right. And they had played these, like, recordings of them talking, going, oh, we're gonna murder our friend, we're super excited about it, and it was just so insane to me. But, and then people were rallying, saying, hey, these kids are young, their brains are still learning, right. They don't know right, yeah. No, you know right from wrong, you were planning.
Not gonna continue is the victim.
Yeah, right?
People forget that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, I get so tired of hearing that.
I know.
Some of these kids are cold-blooded killers at that age. I mean, they're just psychopaths. And
right. Yeah, yeah, they start killing the family pet, you know?
And
it's just kind of like, yeah, it just makes me sick. I think if you take a life, I think every state should have the death penalty. And I know a lot of people disagree with that, but I think that I just read this morning a murderer survived the lethal injection again. So they're really wanting to bring back firing squad.
Yeah, that happened somewhere, and they did do the firing squad somewhere a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
Where the guy survived his lethal injection, and then they said, okay, we're going to do the firing squad, and they did.
Right, yeah, because I think, like, if you survive it, then they give you, like, another year to live before they try again, and I'm just like...
ridiculous.
It is, yeah.
I think that it takes 20 or 30 years from the crime before someone is executed, and I'm only for death penalty for murder if it's the worst of the worst, you know, not every murder, obviously, because there's a lot of different circumstances, but if it's some particularly cruel psychopath or things like that, then, yeah.
Right, exactly. And speaking of psychopaths, in Washington, you guys sure have had your fair share of some heinous serial killers. Like, Ted Bundy did some killings out there. Of course, we have the Green River Killer. We have Robert Lee Yates, the I-5 Bandit. Right. We have even former NFL player Randall Woodfield, Wesley Dodd. I mean, even one of the Hillside Stranglers killed a couple people out there.
Yeah, well, Kenneth Bianchi is in prison here in Washington right now.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about any serial cases that you have worked on?
Oh, yeah, sure. I had a couple. The first one I worked on was a guy. First of all, what I always tell people in these situations is 95% of serial killings nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah.
Because they're not the big numbers like Ridgway actually was arrested. He only lived like 4 miles from me when he got arrested.
Are you serious?
And right in the neighborhood.
Oh.
And some of his victims were dumped less than a mile from my house.
Oh my God.
But anyway, yeah, but he, I mean, those are the ones you hear about, the big numbers, but I had one in the late 90s was the first one I actually personally worked myself, and that was a guy named Dwayne Lee Harris, and he was killing prostitutes in Seattle. And over a period of months, and we finally got him. I did an episode of American Detective with Joe Kenda about that case. And so that was in the episode is called Murder, 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 because that's what I have. So speaking of having tapes, my partner and I interviewed him for hours on end and recorded them all and have some incredible tapes of him saying, you know, what his plans were and how he did it. Now, you know, his plans were to murder all the time, and he got these women to follow him with promise of giving him drugs and stuff, because they're just low-hanging fruit, right? That's the thing. It's the easiest. And so, and we got him eventually. He killed, and he was charged with 3 in Seattle.
Wow.
He claims to have done many, many more. I don't know if that's true or not. And then in 2014, it ended up being a serial case, but it was completely different because it wasn't psychosexual motivation. He was a radicalized Muslim, and it was jihad, and he would just pick people at random and shoot them on the street. And he did 3 in Seattle, and then he went to New Jersey and did 1 in New Jersey. And we ended up catching him in New Jersey and went back there and talked to him. He was a scary guy, too, because he would just look for people, men by themselves, and shoot and kill them. The first 2 he killed in Seattle were both gay men. He met them on Grindr, you know, because, again, low-hanging fruit. It's easy to get on Grindr and things like that. Anyway, he'll go with you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what happened. That's why he got his first 2 in Seattle. And another one he just saw walking down the street.
Wow, that's
killed him, yeah.
That's horrible. You're just going about your business, you know, not knowing that some psycho is about to gun you down, or however they kill you. And it's just, it just always breaks my heart for the person, obviously, but also just speaking from, like, you know, I've lost people to murder, dear friends. Yeah. I just, it really, it's something you never forget. I can't imagine a family member.
One of the things I talk about, especially with serial killers or any killer, and I talked about this in a documentary about Ted Bundy once, when you kill somebody, you drop the stone in the water and the ripple that goes out is all the people that were adversely affected by that.
Yeah.
And for each murder, you might have 100 people, friends and family, that are adversely affected by it. That's how many people. So that's how many victims they are, because they're the secondary victims of homicide, is the friends and family left behind. And so, and they don't consider it. So when you figure guys like Bundy, who had all these ripples everywhere, pretty bad.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just friends and family, but especially in, like, little tiny towns, like, you know, communities themselves, you know, it changes the way, okay, I used to leave my door unlocked when I went, you know, because it was kind of like, yeah, you know, now I'm going to lock that door and now I'm going to look behind my back, and kind of changes people's perspective.
I'm going to walk laps in my backyard instead of on the street.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But mind you, when I'm walking laps in the backyard, I'm listening to the True Crime Podcast. But it's just so sad that there's so many sick people out there, but it keeps,
there are plenty of them.
Yeah. It keeps you guys and gals certainly busy with your jobs. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So during your long career in law enforcement spanning over 3.5 decades, which is just so impressive in my book, is there a case that just still gets to you, just stands out? Maybe it's the one that got away, just could not be solved.
Well, there was one that it got me, and it was when it's officially unsolved, but it got me because it should have been solved, but it's the culture of people. There was this guy, he'd been from New Orleans, and when Katrina happened, it wiped everything out, so he and his family moved to Seattle, and he had a house on a hill, on Beacon Hill, and he had a friend out one night from New Orleans, and it was a nice summer night, and they're out sitting on his porch about midnight or a little after having a beer when these 2 cars stopped in front of his house, and they were in some kind of a road rage situation.
Yeah.
And he looked, and it was right around a curve, and he walked out there, and he said, "Hey guys, pull into my driveway. It's not dangerous. You're gonna get hit." And one of the people pulled out a gun and shot him like 5 times just for no reason, and then they took off. Well, we found out, we actually quickly identified who the person was, and we had him. And we had the other car, had everybody spoke Vietnamese. No, they barely spoke English, not in the witness car. And we started interviewing them, and they told us some details about it. One of them knew one of the people in the car with the suspect and said something about him. Her husband was a security guard at Safeway, and all these details that happened. And we figured out who she was, and everything fit. And we started bringing people in, and everybody lied. Everybody lied. We knew who the suspect was. We actually brought him in 2 or 3 times. And, you know, matter of fact, last time we brought him in, he wasn't a gangbanger at all. He was an installer for DirecTV, but he just wanted, had, you know, thought he was a semi-gangbanger life. And we brought him in, and when he was leaving, he said to his wife, "Tell the kids I won't be home for a long, long time." But we wouldn't have it. We didn't quite have enough charge because everybody, including the people in the witness car, lied, and they wouldn't identify him. The woman that we had, she lied about it, and he had elderly parents that lived in New Orleans, and they would call all the time.
Yeah.
And about, you know, and talk, and I tell him, I said, "We know who did it. You know, we just don't have enough, and the prosecutor wouldn't quite charge, and because we're just a little tiny piece more, we would have had him." And then they would call all the time on his birthday and on holidays. And, you know, I got to know them pretty well, but it was a sad case. And the guy finally moved to Texas. I know the suspect. And I got a call from a Texas sheriff who found out he was the suspect in murder here. And he said, "You want me to go get him?" No. But that case is still open. You know, my old partner was still working it when I left, but
yeah,
that was a bad case because you knew who it was. Everybody knew who it was, but everybody, all the witnesses, everybody lied.
Yeah.
Well, so.
Yeah, that's has to be so excruciatingly frustrating when you know this asshole did it, that he murdered this person who was really just trying to help, saying, "Hey, I'm a safe haven, come here."
No reason.
Yeah, wrong place, yeah, wrong time.
Right in front of his family.
Ugh. Yeah, that's just gut-wrenching. Well,
yeah,
that's horrible. You know who did it, and he's a free man.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Exactly.
Yeah, makes me sick. So, Cloyd, I consider myself lucky enough to have some family and friends in law enforcement, from street cops to sergeants to state troopers and what have you. And one thing many have said when I asked them, what were the toughest cases to them, most mentioned when it had to do with a child, you know, when a sweet,
yeah,
innocent child.
Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, nothing else bothered me.
Yeah.
I didn't, cases seeing adults murdered and stuff, it never bothered me. I mean, sometimes it was sad. I didn't have empathy for the victims and their families.
Right.
But seeing kids, murdered kids, and I've seen a lot of them, that got to me. But I wouldn't let it get to me when I was working. I was still in work mode and, you know, disengaged. But later on, you know, when I got home and stuff, I'd think about it. I had kids of my own, you know, and I knew how there's nothing worse to have to a parent and lose a child. There's nothing you can do in the world.
Right.
Worse than that. Yeah.
Right. Well, not only lose a child, but to murder, you know, it's just like,
it's,
I can't
be something so.
Right. Well,
unnecessary.
I know in your book, you discuss several cases that you've worked on as a homicide detective. One of them had to do with a lady that had a baby, and I printed out a letter that I want to read, but she killed it and discarded it like last week's trash. And when it came time to sentence this monster, this baby killer, you wrote a letter, and I'm going to read that now. "Judge Shapira, I am one of the investigating detectives in the murder of baby boy Davis. Soon you will hold a sentencing hearing for Heidi Davis, who killed baby boy Davis. This will not be like most sentencings. There will be no victim impact statements, no tearful testimony from friends or family about how the death of baby boy Davis adversely affected their lives. Baby boy Davis was never cuddled. He was never loved. He wasn't even given a name. There is no one to stand up for him. Most murder victims do something to make their deaths at the hands of a murderer more likely through choices that they made at their lifestyle or some other factor. Baby boy Davis played no part in his death, save being conceived in the womb of a psychopath, someone who couldn't be bothered, who ignored friends' pleas not to go through with this. She opted to throw him away like yesterday's trash, to slowly suffocate in a plastic bag in the bottom of a garbage can just after the Christmas season. Normally, when a plea agreement is made, the prosecutor's office consults with the case detective. Because of a misunderstanding, that did not happen in this case. Had it happened, I assure you, I would not have agreed to this plea. I ask that you give Heidi Davis the highest sentence under the law for this heinous crime. Detective Cloyd Steiger." Cloyd, can you please talk a little bit about that case and what the outcome was?
She got pregnant, and nobody in her household knew she was pregnant. She was 18 years old and lived in the basement of her grandmother's house. And like I said, gave birth and just put the baby in a plastic bag and threw him in the trash. And she told a friend she was pregnant, and what she was going to do, and the friend said, "No, give it to me. I'll adopt it." You know, and the friend later came forward to me. Unfortunately, she didn't come forward to anybody before this happened. It could have prevented it.
Yeah.
And the prosecutor's office, you know, they kind of low played it from the beginning. They kind of like, you know, because the prosecutor, they were friends of mine, but they were much more liberal than me. And they, you know, one of them said to me, you know, there's some people think you should be able to kill a baby right after birth. This was way back. I mean, when it wasn't so common of a thought, I said,
yeah,
I don't care what people think. That's murder. It's first degree murder. Anyway, they took a plea to second degree manslaughter, the lowest level of homicide there is. And it was an agreed sentence of 4 years, which was outrageous, I thought. And so I did this and, you know, wrote this letter and sent it. My wife and I went to the sentencing, and the judge said she was touched by the letter and gave her the maximum she could, which was only 8 years because of the charge that was agreed to. And so she doubled her time. But I mean, it's just outrageous because I think because the baby has no value or anything. It pissed me off, to tell you the truth.
Oh, yeah, I can't blame you. I mean, especially when a friend said, "I will adopt the baby." I mean, you're literally, I mean, also, hey, put the baby in a little basket and put it in front of the fire station or police department.
Yeah,
you know, there's to be brought into this world, and the person who brought you is taking you out into a trash bag, like you said. And I mean, what a horrible way to go. I mean, just, you know, minutes old, probably. I'm really glad that you wrote that letter. And yeah, 8 years still seems like a slap on the wrist, but that's a hell of a lot better than 4 years.
Yeah.
But still, I agree with you. It should have been a hell of a lot longer.
Well, it should have been charged a lot higher. You know,
right.
It was really charged second degree murder. I thought it should have been charged first degree murder because she premeditated it.
Yeah.
You know, but they charged second degree murder, which they do all the time, and then took a manslaughter 2 plea, which was outrageous.
Yeah.
Manslaughter 2 is if you, using criminal negligence, kill somebody, but it's an accident. It's not on purpose. You know, but you're just negligent. That isn't this case.
Yeah, well, like you said, she was planning this thing. She was telling people, you know.
Yeah.
Just gut-wrenching, for sure. So sometimes the bad guy is the least likely suspect. I was shocked when I read this in your book. Certain retired King County sheriff, not sheriff deputy, but an actual sheriff,
He was a deputy.
Oh, he okay.
The big sheriff. No.
Oh, okay. Well, still, that's crazy. And I know every profession has people that shouldn't be in them. Like, okay, that guy should not be in law enforcement, or this guy shouldn't be whatever. But can you talk a little bit about this retired King County sheriff deputy?
Well, first of all, Ann Rule wrote a book about this.
Oh.
It's in Death, Murder, and Mirrors is the name of Ann Rule's book. Anyway. So I'm working, and I have this guy who is a prolific snitch for me. I mean, he has turned over so many murders for me, and this is the only guy I changed the name of in the book.
Oh,
anyway,
gotcha.
I get a call. He calls me from jail all the time. So I get a call from jail, and he says, "Man, this guy's trying to hire me to kill his whole family." And I go, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he gives me all the details. He says, "He wants me to do this," and he tells me the backstory. And I'm taking some notes. I said, "Let me check in a minute." So I run his name. He's in jail, too. The guy is. And it says, "Retired King County Sheriff's Deputy" on his booking. I'm like, "Oh, shit." So I went over and got my snitch. I brought him back, and I took a big, long recorded statement from him about all this stuff. And he says that he hired him the last time this guy was in jail. And I said, "Well, when was that?" He says, "A few weeks ago." And he gave him $1,000 front money. And he had somebody, he had his sister give it to him. And I said, "What'd you do with the money?" And he goes, "I drank it up."
Oh, no.
And I said, "No, man," because I thought, he could have hired somebody else because he didn't think you were going to do it. So now I'm worried about the victim. So she lived out in Bellevue, which is east of Seattle. And so I got her number, and I'm driving out to her house. It's like 9:30 at night on a weeknight. And I call her house, and I didn't know her. She didn't know me. And I tell her, "I'm coming out to talk to her. I'm the police, blah, 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 blah. Just not to scare you when I knock on your door." And so she says, "Okay." And I get to the house, and of course, I ring the doorbell, and it's a split entry, and she leans out the front window and says, "Do you have a badge or something?" I go, "Yeah," and I show her my badge. And so she comes out to talk to me, and then I tell her that her estranged husband, they're still married, has hired a hitman to kill her. And she goes, I knew it. And I said, you need to get her, you and your kids, everybody, and leave the house tonight. And her sister was also an intended victim. I said, you need to take your sister too, and don't tell anybody in the world where you are going. Just go get a hotel or something. And so she did. In the meantime, we set up this sting operation with him in jail. And it's because my snitch told him he had a black female friend who might come see him. And so there was a female detective that worked sex crimes downstairs. And I got her to do it with me. And we wired her up and sent her over to the jail two different times. And the second time, his wife, her sister, and his then 18-year-old daughter. The female detective said, well, what about your son? He was 14 years old. Wouldn't he just inherit everything? She said, he goes, oh, yeah, let's just clean house. Take them all out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I had the guy write letters to him to, tell him that was legitimate and blah, 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 blah. And so then we ended up going over there, and I went over to the jail and went up to, he was up in the administrative segregation section because he's a former police officer. So that's, you're in a cell 23 hours, 1 hour out every day. You don't mix with other prisoners. But my guy is always up there because he gets in fights in jail. They were talking through the cracks, and during breaks, they talked through the windows of the cells. And my guy was taking notes like he always does. And we got him to, went up to talk to him, and he almost, we're Seattle Police Homicide. And I'm sure he thought we were going to say his family's been murdered. We're there to tell him that. But I burst his bubble by saying, you're under arrest for solicitation for murder. And I went to trial, and my informant had to testify, but he was out of jail. And when he's out of jail, he's drunk and you can't find him. And then he's a mean drunk. Mm. So I scoured the streets at night, and I finally found him, and he was kind of getting in my face. I said, get in the effing car, And I took him to a motel, and I said, I'm coming back tomorrow. You better be here. And he did. And I said, long story short, but see, the problem is he's got such a bad liver. When he's drunk, it takes him 3 or 4 days to sober up. So he was still drunk when he went to court and testified. He did a good job. And the guy got convicted.
Oh my God. Yeah. When I was reading that, I had to reread it because it's like, okay, this dude who was in law enforcement, sheriff's deputy, he wants to take out his wife, his sister-in-law, his daughter. And then, hey, let's throw in my son, too, like just like a grocery list. Oh, yeah, add onions to the list.
Well, because she came into some money, was upset to inherit some money, and he thought he could get it all. They were going to get divorced. He was in jail for domestic violence assault against her.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I'm really glad that your guy came through.
I'm actually still friends with that family. They came to my retirement party.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. By the way, I retired 8 years ago today.
Really?
Yeah, March 8th, yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's really awesome. Well, I'm sure you're enjoying retirement. I know you're still doing stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about
doing stuff, but it's different.
Yeah, yeah.
Schedule.
Yeah, you get to, not wake up at, 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, I'm sure.
Right, all the time, yeah.
Yeah. So, you are the kind of detective that attends autopsies of the cases that you worked, something that, surprisingly, is not done by all. I would think that
it should be.
Yeah, it should be, right? Yeah, I would think so.
You learn a lot watching the autopsy. You learn little facts.
Right.
That you may not make it in the translation if you're just talking to a pathologist on the phone or something. And then when you get the guy, if he says something that matches that, it's true.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're working this case that has to do with the human life no longer being on this earth, and you want to get all the information that you can possibly get, And so
a good example is that serial killer I was talking about, Dwayne Lee Harris.
Yeah.
One of his victims, he cut her throat, right? Mm. And so I went to the autopsy, and there were 3 distinct slash wounds on her neck. Mm. 3 distinct ones. So when I had him, and he was finally confessing, he said, I cut her throat. I said, did you cut her throat once, Dwayne? He goes, no, I cut her throat 3 times. So
wow.
That tells you right there. That was a confirming factor in his statement.
Right, absolutely. So he cut her throat 3 times. Was she nearly decapitated? Or?
Yeah, well, they were really, really deep. And really, yeah, I mean, I'm not quite as, I've been to people that have been more nearly decapitated, but she was pretty bad.
Wow. Yeah, that's heartbreaking. So Besides that case, can you talk a little bit about other cases that maybe you learned just because of the autopsy itself?
There's so many of them. I mean,
Yeah.
one of them was Francis Patrick Fleming, and this case has been featured on three different true crime TV shows. The first one was called, and every time they call about it, I say, this has been done before. They all say, yeah, we're going to do it different. The first one was called something After Dark or something like that on Investigation Discovery, and they talked about this case. The second one was Killer Instinct with Chris Hansen. He did this case, and I met Chris Hansen in that. And then the third one was an Oxygen show called Masterminds of Murder, which I forgot the name of the episode, but I was flying to Las Vegas about a month and a half ago with my wife, and I'm on the plane, and I'm on the thing, TV shows and movies available, I'm flipping through, and that one was on there. I said, my show is on this plane.
Wow, that's
Yeah.
cool.
Anyway, it's about it's that's a long, convoluted story about a band of gypsies that want to get this guy as a coin collection, and rare coin collection thing. And this one gypsy woman finds out about it, and so she wants to get it, so she decides that they're going to go into this guy's assisted living facility in Seattle and kill him and steal his collection. And they did, and that's when he was almost decapitated. He didn't have it so bad,
Oh.
but that one was important, and because at the autopsy, you could see that there were huge slash wounds to both sides of the neck, not just one,
Yeah.
and that there were small puncture marks in his chest, almost like torture marks. And then when I finally figured out who this was, my partner and I figured out who this was, and we brought him in. Of course, they lied at first, but we had him trapped.
Yeah.
And speaking of guys that surprised us who it was, there's this one guy who, he wasn't a gypsy, but he was just this dolt ex cab driver that would drive this woman gypsy around for no reason. And we knew there was a male because we found foreign male DNA blood at the scene, and you can tell it's male because it has a Y chromosome in it. She had this husband, quote unquote, I don't know if it was a real husband, but he was this big burly guy, and we thought it was probably him. And we had set up pole cameras at their place, which are cameras that are set up on utility poles that look down and record 24/7 comings and goings, and you can control them from any internet connection. You log in and zoom in, zoom out, and do this. And this guy would go out and smoke outside every day. So we had an undercover detective out there dressed in a vest and a helmet. He went out there with a broom and dustbin and swept up all the cigarette butts where this guy does it normally. And then went back and we watched until that guy went out and smoked and threw another cigarette butt down. And then I zoomed in on that cigarette butt, and the same detective came out, picked it up, put an envelope, and sent it in for DNA testing. And then we found out that it wasn't him. So we had no idea who the male was. It ended up being this doofus cab driver guy who'd never had anything with traffic in his life. He'd been stabbed or cut while they were doing this. And he finally rolled, and we got the second girl to roll. And the main one, she asked for a lawyer right away, so we didn't get a statement from her, but she got convicted and sent to prison.
And I mean, I'm so glad they were apprehended and caught and doing time now. And I mean, this coin collector, he was not their only intended victim, right? They had
No, and they
somebody.
were going to do it to another old guy the same night. They went to another apartment, but this guy was a retired King County sheriff, actually. And he said, I got a gun. So they turned and ran. I don't know if he really had a gun or not, but he told him he did. And so they ran and then went over and killed. Patrick was what he went by, but it was Francis Patrick Fleming.
No, so heartbreaking, I mean, just for some coins. I mean, yeah, sure, I'm sure they were valuable, but a life is much more valuable for sure.
He was a Vietnam veteran with a bunch of medals. They stole that too.
Oh,
And they threw him in the ship canal. We never recovered the medals. We did
really?
recover the knives they used, which they also threw in the ship canal, because the one woman took us down there and showed us where they threw him in. We put divers and they found the knives.
Yeah, just people, So, in your book, another case that you discuss is a massacre that occurred in a local coffee shop, the Cafe Racer. Can you talk a little bit about the Cafe Racer massacre?
Well, Cafe Racer is near the University of Washington, and it's a bistro place. At night, it's a bar, but during the day, it's like a coffee place. And they have regulars. They have live music there at night. They have regulars that are there. And one day on a Thursday, I think, about 10 o'clock in the morning, a bunch of people were sitting at the bar, and the bartender's working, and some guy comes in, and he had been a regular there, but he was crazy. And he'd been 86. They told him he couldn't come back anymore because he caused problems. And so he goes in there, and we have this all on surveillance video. There's no sound, but he walks up, and the guy working the counter, he says, "You're not supposed to be here." And the guy goes, "I just want a cup of coffee to go." And he goes, "Okay, I'll make a cup of coffee to go. But then you got to go." And you go, okay. And he's sitting there, and there's two guys sitting right to his left, and he starts to try to talk to him, and they're kind of looking away because they knew who he was, too. And then one of them gets up to leave and is walking away, and this guy pulls out a pistol out of his pocket and shoots that guy right in the back of the head. And then he starts shooting everybody in the place, and he's shooting left and right. One guy is throwing chairs at him, trying to stop him. There was one girl sitting on her computer by the door, and she luckily ran out and got out and wasn't hurt. But then he just walked around the back, and people were hiding under the bar, and he shot them under the bar. Everybody died that was shot except the bartender guy, my God, my mind just blank.
Barista?
He kept serving coffee. He spent like 7 months in the hospital and got out. But in the meantime, this guy leaves. Like, it's a beautiful weekday morning, and I'm at the scene, and there's, you know, it's pandemonium at the scene. Of course, there's fire engines and medic units and a dozen police cars, and we're there, and I'm looking at the scene, and then Bob Valor, who was my sergeant, comes up and says, "Hey, just got a call about a homicide, a shooting downtown. They're asking for homicide. Would you go down there and see what's going on?" I go, "Yeah, I'll go." So I get in my car, and I go ripping downtown, again, right in the middle of a busy street, and there's this building, and this woman was going to a work meet inside this building, and she parked her car. But when she got out, she was walking, and somebody walked up and shot her right in the head. Boom. And then stole her car.
Jeez.
And so I'm thinking, wow. And I noticed, this is so random, you know?
Yeah.
And I noticed that there's a casing on the ground. I get down and look at it. It's a 45. So I call back up to the scene there, and I say, is that a 45 you got up there? And I don't know. We don't know yet. I said, well, let me know as soon as, because I think this one could be related to that one. And the thing is, because that's a lot of violence in a day, you know, random violence like that.
Yeah.
But the question was, could this guy have made it from there to downtown? Because they were 30 minutes apart, and it's heavy traffic. And I made it, but I was going lights and siren, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. But could he have made it downtown that fast? And so we're looking, and finally they call, yeah, it's a 45. And I go, I think this is the same guy. And so because they have the surveillance video, and then they put out, they figure people tell who the guy is, and they put out a thing. It's all over the news. Look for this guy. And there's an undercover officer working in West Seattle, which is diametrically across the whole city from the University of Washington scene. And he sees this guy, and he goes, and he's not an unmarked police car. He's undercover. I mean, he's driving a car that's just a regular car. And he has a portable. He gets on. He goes, I think I see that suspect. And he says where he is. So a patrol car comes down, and you can see the video for the patrol car. This guy's walking down the street. He goes, stop, police. And the guy looks, and he reaches in and gets down on his knees and, boom, shoots himself in the head and kills himself.
Wow.
Before that, I got ahead of myself, because before that, downtown victim's car was found in West Seattle on an arterial. So we were scouring that area. We didn't know where he went from there. This is quite a way south from where the car was found. But he ended up killing himself that night, and, you know, his family was so devastated, because they said, we've been trying to tell people he's dangerous for years, but nobody would do anything. And it takes this, you know, because they said, we should have said he was armed when he wasn't, you know. And so, ironically, it also in West Seattle, this is probably when a boy went out there, we found out later, he had like a third grade teacher that lived out there. She had not seen him since the third grade. She had no idea anything about, and this guy's like 27 now. He left flowers and a note on her door of her house. So he'd been stalking her. Thank God she wasn't home, because he probably would have killed her too.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's scary. She dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, literally.
Literally, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's just kind of like, you know, he woke up one day and said, I think I'm going to do a spree killing. I think I'm going to go out and kill.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
How sad
there
is that?
There are a lot of, I've been to a few spree, you know, mass shooters or spree killings.
Yeah.
That was pretty, it got made national news because of, you know, first of all, I have the video of the shooting inside, and it's pretty horrific.
There's this a show on Investigation Discovery called See No Evil, and It is all about catching, you know, killers on cameras, you know, because the cameras never waver, they never lie,
I've
and
never seen it. I know this can be hard to believe, but I don't watch true crime shows. I do this for a living. I don't need to watch TV about it.
Right. Well, this show is eerie because it will, like, you know, tar it will like talk about one case, and then they'll follow the victim through video cameras, and it captures the last moments of their life.
Right,
And a lot
yeah.
of the times, it shows them getting kidnapped and murdered, and it just is
Right.
so eerie. So to know, okay, we're gonna watch this, knowing that a massacre took place, that people were murdered, and we're gonna see
Right.
them die in front of us, that has to be like just like kind of spine tingling, bone chilling to
Yeah.
you.
Anyway, for me, it was great because it was great evidence. You know, that's
Right.
what I'm
Right,
Yeah.
exactly.
Again, I'm thinking clinically, I'm not thinking emotionally.
No,
Yeah.
yeah. After retirement, which by the way, happy 8-year anniversary,
Thanks.
you were asked by the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases if you could look into some of their cases and help them.
Yeah.
And I just have to say, with the advancements in DNA, it is just so
Oh, yeah.
phenomenal. How many
Yeah.
cold cases decades later are being solved? It warms my heart when I see in the morning, first thing I do is like, you know, read my news. And it's like you'll see like this old picture, probably 50 years old, of a girl. And in my head, I know immediately, okay, her case was
Yeah.
solved. And
Yeah, you know, that happens. It used to be unheard of. Now it's routine, and because of
yeah.
the advancements of forensics. And I have friends that I actually started doing that before I retired,
Okay.
but I continued after I retired and became their director of investigation consulting. But and I have friends that I still stay in touch with that we were all together from that. You know, one guy is a criminologist, another's a DNA expert, and we talk about this stuff. Matter of fact, two of those people is I'm a regular on their podcast, which is Citizen Detective Podcast. I'm a regular guest every episode. We go over a case, but we talk about how. And the other thing that amazes me is you look at these cases that happened 30 years ago,
Yeah.
and if rape and murder and binding of this woman, you think this guy's got to be a serial killer. Yeah, all this stuff is psychopath, and then you find out he's never been suspected of any other murders at all. How does that happen? Unless,
Yeah.
you know, they just haven't done the DNA on the other cases. And so you're never going to see the big numbers you used to see in serial cases now because of the advancements in forensics and in genealogy and, you
Yeah.
know, how little DNA and how you can find DNA off of. I'm good friends with the president of the MVAC Corporation, which is a wet vacuuming DNA collection system, which is it's just incredibly blown things up where you can get DNA off stuff you could never get it before. And yeah, they're based out of Utah, but they're worldwide, and people are taking these old cases out and doing MVAC on them and getting DNA where they'd already test them and couldn't find enough or couldn't find any, and then they're finding plenty to get it now. So that was a huge step forward in forensics.
Right, absolutely. And it's like it's nice when so many years later, when there's surviving family members that could go, okay, this is what happened. This is who
Yeah,
was
I mean, yeah, it's pretty
responsible.
satisfying to talk to the families when that happens, right? Because there's nothing worse in the world. The worst in the world is when a family member, especially a kid, just disappears and you never know what happened,
Yes.
right? That's the worst thing.
Right.
The next worst thing is somebody was murdered and it isn't solved, and you and I have an idea why it happened or who did it or anything with that. At least, and there's no such thing as closure in murder cases.
Yeah.
They use that all the time, but at least there's that satisfaction of knowing who the person was, and hopefully, if they're still alive, getting them to go to jail. A lot of them they find are already dead when they identify them, but you
Right.
know that at least that closes a door in the whole thing. So.
Right. Well, and then it's also like, okay, they can never hurt somebody else's daughter or son
Exactly,
or
exactly.
anybody. And so, yeah, no, that's good. So Cloyd, can you talk a little, if you're able to, about maybe a cold case that you helped work on that was solved?
Let me think. Well, that's what I'd like to tell a lot because of the interrogation. And you know, I wasn't involved in the early, my old partner, Mike Sosinski, went to cold cases full time, and I didn't. And he would call me or come to me because we're in the same office
Yeah.
when he needed help with something, I'd help him. And one of them was this like 75-year-old woman who was raped and murdered in her house, again, down in Rainier Valley in like 81, 82, which was ironic because I was a patrol officer in that neighborhood during that time. I didn't go to this call. But anyway, she was found raped and murdered, and her neighbor and her neighbor's son, who was 17 or 18 at the time, had found her and called the police and everything. And so Mike gets this case, and he starts. And the first thing you do with these is you look at what your evidence is. What's been tested? Let's test this all again. And they did, and they found DNA, and they found it that it links the 18-year-old kid. It was his DNA at the scene.
Wow.
Right. So Mike had already talked to him and got a DNA sample from him under the guise of, I'm looking at this, and you know, you're a witness, I want to talk to you about it. So he called him in again, and I went and sat in with an interrogation, and we're sitting there, and he's talking about this lady who was her mom's good friend, and he, you know, he said, when she was out of town, he'd watch her house. I said, whenever you were in her house, did you ever take anything? And he goes, no, I never took anything. I go, did you ever leave anything? He goes, no, I never left anything. I go, oh, you left something. He was like, what? And then we finally get him trapped. And she was raped. Okay, 75-year-old woman raped and murdered. She was found on her bed with her legs spread wide, strangled, you know, naked from the waist down. He would admit to killing her, but he said it wasn't sexual. It wasn't sexual? I said, did you have an erection? Well, yeah. Did you ejaculate? Yeah, but it wasn't sexual. Don't tell my mom, he said. Don't tell my mom.
Oh, jeez. Anyway. Wow.
So anyway, then he says, can I use the phone? I said, who do you want to call? I want to call my girlfriend. Okay, so we have a phone. We bring in it, plugged into the wall in there, and set it on the table. We walk out, but there's, you know, on the other side of the glass, we're watching what he says, and he picks up the phone. He calls his girlfriend, and he says, yeah, you know all those CSI shows I watch all the time? One of them came back to bite me in the ass.
Wow.
And he got convicted. I don't think it was a trial. He pled guilty. There was another one. Oh, here's one. So I was relatively new in homicide. I was working cases and stuff, and I came across or read an article about this murder that happened up on Capitol Hill in Seattle in 1979. I was actually in the police academy when it happened.
Wow.
And so this woman who worked at a Red Robin, actually she worked at the original Red Robin, the first one ever, which was down by the University of Washington.
Really?
She was a waitress. Yeah, yeah. And she was a waitress there, and didn't show up for work one day.
Mm.
And they're calling and calling. She, you know, they don't know anything about it. So they go to, they send somebody to her apartment, get the manager to open the door, and they find her bound and strangled and dead on her bed.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
So I read about this, and I thought, I should pull this case and see if there's anything we could do, because it was cold, you know.
Yeah.
So I called down to archives, and I ordered up the case, and they brought it. It was this big box, and I started going through it. It was an interesting case. And I'm going through it, and I'm reading the whole thing, learning about it. One of the things that was interesting is that this woman who worked at the University Hospital, it's not far from this restaurant, she called and said one night she was getting off work at midnight, and she left the hospital, and she saw this car following her. It was a Volkswagen. It isn't Ted Bundy, by the way. She saw this car following her. Yeah, Ted Bundy was already in custody when this all happened. And she thought, oh my gosh, what's this? And so she drove around, and he kept following her, and she was afraid to go home.
Aww.
So she pulled into this random apartment complex, parked her car, got out, and walked down between two buildings and back around the corner. And she sat there for like a half an hour. And then she came back out, and that car was still sitting there.
Oh no.
And yeah, and the guy rolled down, hey, do you need help? And he goes, no, she was almost out of gas. That's the other thing.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm just almost out of gas. And he goes, oh, I'll give you a ride. And so he creeped her out, but she got in the car with him,
which is
amazing. And they drove her to her apartment, and he said, can I come in? And she said, no, I have a boyfriend. And he said, oh, will you give me a kiss? And of course she didn't. He goes, hey, give me a call sometime, and maybe we can get together. And he writes his name and number on the phone. It was Randy Woodfield.
I just mentioned him earlier.
Yeah, I know you just mentioned him. That's what reminded me when you said it earlier.
No way.
And I thought, but he wasn't known as a serial killer back then.
Yeah.
And so the detectives working it didn't think anything of it. Just some weird guy.
Yeah.
But I thought to myself, well, shit, I should just go down to Oregon and interview him. Maybe he'll admit doing this. And I was planning on doing that. But in the meantime, you know, in those times you worked cold cases when you had extra time. But the problem is you never had extra time. And one day I'm in the office, and it's a Sunday. Nobody's in the office but me, and the main phone rings, and this girl's name was Sylvia Durante, by the way, the victim. The main phone rings in the homicide office. I answer it, and there's a man on there. He goes, hey, my wife and I are in town. Our daughter was killed years ago, and we just wanted to talk to somebody about it. And I said, is this Mr. Durante? And he's like, what? Yeah, yeah. Well, wow. Why don't you come on up? And I said, come, and I went down to the door, and it was locked. I let him in. We came up, and I had the box, and we went through the file, and he was just so happy that somebody remembered his daughter, aww. Which if it had been anybody else, they would not have. It just happened. I was in there when, and I had read about the case, or I would have never even known about it either. And so we went through this whole thing. I said, I'm going to, you know, they had prints in there. I'm going to run these through APHIS again. They haven't run in years and see if anything pops up. And, well, anyway, long story short, my other partner at the time, his name's Greg McSell, that's when they formed the first cold case unit, and he was going to it, okay? And I said, Greg, here's this case. You got to look at this. Start doing stuff on this. And so eventually, when he got around, he did, and he sent stuff in for DNA, and he found DNA of a guy that was convicted of rape, and they got him and brought him in. And what happened was, we're looking through the file for his name. The only place his name was in that file, because most of the time the killer's name is in there somewhere, but he had taken a stained glass class with her, but he was not a suspect ever in this case. So it was on a list of all the people in her class, and he was on there, but that was it. And he got convicted of that murder. And it was, you know, seeing the parents at the trial when he got convicted, that was satisfying.
Oh, man, I can only imagine. And
yeah, I thought sure it was Randy Woodfield when I saw that his name was in there.
Yeah, wow, that's wild for sure.
Yeah.
And that is just so heartwarming that you were the one there. And I can only imagine how...
Yeah, just by coincidence. I mean, what are the odds of that?
Right?
There's anybody in there on a Sunday like that.
Right. And I can only imagine how the father felt, like, okay, my daughter...
He was very happy that we remembered his daughter.
Right.
He saw that a lot of work had been done on our case, because it was a big box. It wasn't just a folder or a binder. It was a big box of stuff.
Right. Yeah, she may be gone, but she was not forgotten, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's good. These days, you are a private investigator. How is that going for you?
My phone rings every single day, you know, it's like, and I get, well, the other thing is my phone rings every single day, once at least with some absolute nut.
Oh boy.
Send me these, oh my God, the FBI is spying on me and this and that, and, you know, CIA, and oh my God, my house is bugged. They know everything I'm doing. Oh, okay. I said, well, I charge $200 an hour. Click.
Yeah.
I can do that, but it's going to cost you like $3,000.
Right. Oh, that's funny. Well, that's good that business is still going.
I get a lot of, you know, unsolved murders, or, you know, or people whose family members died and they think under suspicious circumstances.
Oh, wow.
I had one woman, a very nice woman, and this was actually out of Wisconsin, and her son and his girlfriend who lived together were found dead in an apartment, and the police there were convinced, told it was homicide, suicide. Her son had killed the girl and then killed himself, and she said, no, it's a double homicide, and she said the girl's ex-husband was the suspect, and so she sent me, I said, I'll look at it, and I look at it, but I, you know, just like people hire me to be an expert witness too, lawyers, and I say, okay, I'm just telling you, though. My opinion is my opinion. It doesn't change by who's hiring me.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is, it is. That's the fact. And okay. But anyway, so this woman sent me, and I went over all this stuff. And at the end, I told her, I wrote a report. He said, your son killed her and then killed himself. The evidence was absolutely equivocal.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I mean, yeah. And she, you know, maybe the small agency that did it didn't cover everything they could have covered, but they ended up in the right answer.
Oh.
And so she was not happy about that, but I said, you know, it is what it is. And I told her how, you know, I admired her for working hard on this. But the other thing is, the guy she said did it, well, these people had a camera system in their home, and it was pointed out, but it had audio, and it captured the gunshots, so you knew exactly when it happened.
Right.
He was in his lawyer's office at that time. I said, either his lawyer is lying and willing to risk her entire career and get disbarred, or he was in her office. What do you think the odds are she's going to do that for some guy?
Right.
He was in her office when this happened. He didn't do it.
It's kind of like, you're hiring me to do this, but you might not like the answers.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you what the truth is. I'm actually involved in another one, a murder that happened in 1979 in Mississippi.
Oh.
But the suspect is known and lives in this area now. That's why I got hired for it. And I've done a lot of work on this. And this is a case that should have been charged years ago.
Mm.
But there's still work around that. I talk to this mother all the time about this case. We've actually become friends kind of over it, but she lives in Maryland. The murder happened in Mississippi, and the suspect lives locally here. And there's no question that he killed her. And there's a guy that came forward and said, I was with him and helped him get rid of the body. But the police there say, oh, he's lying. No, he's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez. And so to this day, he's a free man?
He is, yeah.
Ugh.
Hopefully not for long.
Yeah, hopefully not for long, for sure.
I'm sorry, the year I said was wrong. It was the 1990s. I don't think it was the 70s. Anyway, go ahead.
I just really respect what you do. And I just, you know, it's people like you that give these families hope. And like you said, I agree. It's not closure because it won't bring their loved one back. But
right.
It just, like, you know, gives them the answers. And sometimes it's not what they want. Like, that woman didn't want her.
It is what it is.
Right.
It is what it is. The facts are the facts.
Right. Absolutely. So keep up that phenomenal work. So final question, Cloyd, before we end things here. Earlier, I asked about your first murder that you worked on. Can you talk a little bit about your final murder as a Seattle homicide detective?
Okay, well, there's a difference. There's the final murder I responded to or the final murder that I had investigative responsibility for. The final murder that I responded to was a nothing burger. I got a call. I was already scheduled to leave. I got a call in the middle of the night. There was some guy downtown found dead, shot.
Mm.
And so I got in my car for the last time. As a matter of fact, I was getting ready and my wife was there, and she always, whenever I got called out, she goes, what's going on? And I told her, she said, what's going on? Some shooting downtown. She goes, you know, this could be your last one. I said, I was just thinking that. And so I did go down there, and there's a guy dead on the sidewalk. He'd been transported. He wasn't even there. There was just a blood spot on the sidewalk. Tape up, and it happened outside a building, and it wasn't my case. And the whole thing was captured on a surveillance video, because every inch of downtown is covered by surveillance video. And so I'm there, and I'm standing this sergeant who had only been in homicide a short time, Guy Pratt. He's there, and I'm looking at it, and it's a windy day, blustery, and looking at it. And I said, Guy, there's nothing for me to do here. I'm going home. He said, okay. So I turned around and I left. And I remember looking in the rear mirror and seeing the yellow tape fluttering in the wind. And that was the end. What a going out on a dud.
Wow.
I mean, the case was solved. They arrested the people, you know, very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of a flat note to end it on.
Yeah. Well. I think you have so many cases that you could write several books.
Yeah. I only picked out, you know, when people would ask me, when I tell them, okay, you need to write a book, you need to write a book. I have a bite. When I had the Angelica Robinson, you know, every time there's a murder in Seattle, they type up a one-page summary of the murder, and they send it out to all the detectives in the unit and the command staff so they know what happened.
Yeah.
And I got mine, and I said, I'm going to keep this. This is my first one. And I kept every single one of my entire career.
Wow.
So now I have a binder that's about 2 inches thick. Each individual page is a separate murder that I worked on. So I go through them, you know, I went through them and I say, oh, this is an interesting case. And a lot of them I already had the file from when they were computerized, because I just downloaded my whole drive when I left and kept all my computerized files. But the ones I had before I was computerized, I ordered up from the vault and made copies of them. So I had those, and I'd go through them, and that's what I used. That was kind of my outline. And I just went chronologically through the book, and I picked out one. A lot of them are not interesting at all, in my opinion, right? Somebody that's into this might think they're really interesting, but I don't think so. I call them misdemeanor murders or routine homicides.
But
I picked out the ones that either the case was interesting or something funny happened during it, you know, or it's fine. If you can't laugh at murder, what can you laugh at, right? Or just interesting twists and things. I looked for those cases, and that's what I wrote the book about.
Right. Yeah, well, I really like it. You guys, I recommend you get that too. Yeah, Cloyd, I really just again want to say thank you again for being on the podcast. I had a really great time talking with you and learning more about your cases. And again, thank you for your service. You've made a difference in just so many people's lives and getting answers for the murders of their loved ones and bringing people to justice. So And you continue to do so to this day. So I thank you, and you are a hero.
Thanks.
Definitely a neat guy for sure. Be sure to check out the podcast that he is regularly on. It's called Citizen Detective Podcast. Out of the large jar of my cities, I have picked the following for this week's special city shoutouts: Asheville, North Carolina; Canterbury, Connecticut; Blackwood, New Jersey; Kayseri, Turkey; Salisbury, Maryland; and Cricklewood, England. Thanks, everybody. It is greatly appreciated. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to worry. Hit up any of those podcast platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Player FM, TuneIn Radio. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.